Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 13th of June. Coming up on the program, just hours to go before the formation of a government of national unity. Do we have the maturity for cooperative politics? The plane crash death of a senior Malawian political figure, what will the impact be? The stigma around monkeypox, a tax clampdown on Chinese online platforms, and why Johannesburg is becoming a global dining experience. I think it's fair to say that South Africans do not have a deep culture of coalition. There have been a few at provincial and municipal level. Most of these have proven unstable. So are we able to navigate an era of cooperative politics? Where are the traps and can we find the political maturity? I want to talk now to Philip Berger, who is Dean, Faculty of Economic and Management Sciences, also Professor of Economics at the University of the Free State. And Professor, first of all then, what in your opinion are the key challenges that the country faces in forming a stable coalition at the national level?
I think it's basically twofold. First of all, we do not have a culture of coalitions in South Africa. So it will take a bit of time for us to get used to it, to get used to the notion that you need to compromise when you enter a coalition agreement. So that's on the first level. It's a matter of getting used to a culture of coalition formation. The second difficulty, of course, is that the political parties involved have quite significant differences. And some of these are deeply ideological or philosophical differences. And these need to be traversed if we want to form successful coalition governments that will not run into trouble a few months into the coalition.
So how do they navigate that in order to prevent policy deadlock?
I think the first thing they really need to do is to identify a list of things that they can talk about that are open for negotiation. And then secondly, a list of red line items. In other words, items that are non-negotiable. And then a coalition needs then to be formed on those items that where you can agree on coalition. So these might be economic aspects or whatever. And then you need to decide those aspects where you can't agree, you know, can you put them on the back burner and deal with that through a later election?
It's also important that all parties concerned try to strip ego out of the whole process. Not always easy in the political realm.
Really not easy in the political realm, and I think probably unrealistic for us to expect. You know, there's politics is all about grandstanding, and you know, publicity is not necessarily bad, even if it's bad news that you want to convey. So they often do whatever it is to capture the limelight, and some grandstanding will always be part of it.
Just in terms of the parties that will be outside of any arrangement, and I'm specifically thinking of the Economic Freedom Fighters and the Umkhonto we Sizwe party, they are disaffected and they also have the potential, I imagine, to cause problems outside of any coalition. It's important, though, that they are recognized and understood. How difficult do you think that's going to be, Professor, for any government of national unity?
I think we, in this case, we need to look at it a bit deeper, and we need to really try and understand what is it that caused voters to vote for these parties. And I think the grievances are deep-seated and include feelings of exclusion. So to take the EFF as an example, so the EFF was formed about a decade ago, and attracts mostly younger voters. That's primarily because people like Floyd Shivambo and Julius Malema came from the ANC Youth League. And they represent a cohort of voters who feel excluded, who feel that, you know, the deal struck in 1994 is not a deal that really works for them. And we really need to think about what to do as a country about that. The same goes for MK. In that case, it's a bit more complex because, somebody like Jacob Zuma seems to play a bit of an ethnic card there in trying to mobilize the Zulu vote, although it's not just Zulu voters who vote for MK, but a large majority are. So there too, we need to ask, you know, why are these voters feeling excluded? Just 12 years ago, KZN was the province that that brought the most delegates to the ANC's 2012 conference in Bloemfontein. And, you know, just 12 years on, those voters feel very, very excluded. And I think for whatever government comes in, they need to have a look at that. And what we've seen is that something like grants and so on, that's not doing the trick anymore. That's not helping anymore. You can't satisfy voters with that. And then I think there are specific reasons for that. You know, grants are a palliative to help you put food on the table and so on, but it doesn't give you a long-term vision of where the country is going, particularly if you are an unemployed person, a young person, or any person of any age. You don't see where things are going to go that will improve your future.
Just in terms of the construct of Parliament itself, it would seem that different parties are going to be given the opportunity to chair portfolio committees. That's a good thing, mm-hmm. right?
That is a good thing. I think that will help because the role of Parliament is primarily to keep the executive accountable. And, you know, as we've seen through the state capture years, they dismally failed in doing that. So if you have chairs from different parties, I think that can assist in getting holding government, the executive particularly, accountable.
Just a final one. Do you give this GNU a chance? Do you think it's going to work?
I think it's going to be tough. I mean, it's going to take a bit of work. And you see, I think the other problem that we may face is that South Africa is in a perpetual election mode. So in 2 years' time, it's local elections again. So in little more than a year, the parties will start to ramp up their campaigns again. And, you know, if you are two parties, let's say in this case, which seems to be the most likely coalition that we might get, let's say the ANC and the DA, in a little bit more than a year's time, these two parties will again be competing in the next election. So that will introduce grandstanding and strains and egos and so on. And to work together on a daily basis on the one hand in a national government, but also go out and compete in let's say, local government election. And that is going to put some strain on the relationship.
Professor Berger, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa is dealing with an mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, outbreak, and there are now concerns that people may not come forward if they are infected for fear of stigmatization. This is a warning by bioinformatician at the South African National Bioinformatics Institute, Peter van Heusden, and he joins us now. And first of all, given the recent cases of mpox, what measures, in your opinion, should be taken to identify and then contain local transmission effectively?
So, look, mpox generally has quite distinctive symptoms. The little kind of pox doesn't look like anything else. So that means that obviously medical professionals, doctors and so on should make themselves aware of what to look for. And obviously we don't know particularly who's been affected, but you can be contagious for quite some time. So I would hope that whoever does have a diagnosed case of mpox is getting whatever support that they need to be able to safely keep away from close contact to people. It would be wonderful if we had the mpox vaccine available in South Africa. I don't see that happening anytime soon. It's monopolized by a single company and it's very expensive. But yeah, so at the moment, observation and then kind of contact tracing, both in terms of, you know, who have you been in contact with, but also trying to find out, you know, if there have been any things that we can say might have accelerated transmission, you know, so trying to find out more about a spread, which I'm sure the epidemiologists in ICD are already busy with. But so these are the main things. So raising awareness, especially in the medical community, about what to look for, and then supporting people to help limit the spread would be, I think, the starting points.
Peter, is there any way in which contact tracing efforts can be better enhanced?
So contact tracing, the thing is that when we say close contact, right, and I think this is the thing that maybe we can raise awareness on, is that we're talking about typically close skin-to-skin contact, right? And we're talking about something that sometimes can have a sexual component, not always. And this is not an easy thing to talk about. So what I think we need to do once we have a better handle on the communities involved is to basically say, look, what can be done better to build trust and start identifying within which communities do we need to be educating people about what actions you can take. It is unfortunately much more difficult to do so when you can't really give anybody a specific action to take besides like isolate. We can't say, look, come to us and we'll give you a treatment, or we'll vaccinate everybody in this community and things like that. So in other words, our tools are limited, but contact tracing and trust building are the two things that work together. I mean, NICD has done a great job of kind of communicating the basic, like, you know, statistics and science of what's going on, but we are going to have to see how we translate that into communication and trust building that's more focused. And that's going to make contact tracing easier, because in a situation where you don't always know exactly who you've been in contact with, okay, let me paint a scenario that could illustrate some of these problems. Imagine that you, and I'm not saying anything about you in particular, but you in general, go somewhere, a club, things are really nice, and you hit it off with somebody, you end up having a one-night stand. Now you show up sometime later with this painful rash that then turns out to be mpox, right? Now somebody comes to your door and says, look, we need to talk to you about your contacts. How can we change things so that contact tracing becomes more effective in this scenario? We already have all the education about, like, look, condomize, don't have too many sexual partners, but we know that this is a reality of life, right? Parties happen and you know, the things happen besides what people will talk about at the Sunday lunch. So how can we talk about making it normalized to act more safely? And then work with communities to basically say, look, how can we limit risky behavior? So this is one of the problems that we always have with, I'm definitely not saying that this is what's driving our current mpox cases, but what we've seen in the global outbreak is that these are precisely some of the problems that we've encountered, and they've been resolved best by communities that can have within community conversations about increasing safety and decreasing risky behavior.
And Peter, just a final one then, against that backdrop, what is your assessment of the current state of preparedness of South Africa's healthcare system to handle a potential outbreak?
I think that we have to risk into context. This is not high numbers of cases. I think that we still are adequately prepared. As I said, I would have wished that we don't have the repeat of the kind of vaccine apartheid that we saw during COVID-19, which we are seeing. And I think that we can perhaps do more to translate the science message into language that's more accessible to people. You know, besides mpox, when I look at like other diseases where, you know, sexually transmitted diseases and things like that, I do feel that as a society, we could do better, like risky behaviors and things, especially in a society with as much, like, you know, alcohol consumption and things as we have in this society. But so I think on a society level, we could do better. I think the health authorities are doing a good job. But I think that as a society, we are not, fortunately, opening ourselves to too many risks by the way that we behave as South Africans. And I'm not saying that to stigmatize anybody. I'm just saying that, like, we do need to look into, you know, having some serious conversations with each other about, like, what are we doing to keep ourselves and other people safe?
I'm going to leave it there. Peter van Heusden, thank you very much indeed, from the National Bioinformatics Institute. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Dr. Saulus Chilima, Malawi's vice president and a possible future leader of the country, dying earlier this week after a plane went down in the center of the country. So what does this mean for Malawi's politics? More now from Dr. William Mpofu, who is a researcher at the Wits Center for Diversity Studies. And first of all, Dr. Mpofu, what was Dr. Chilima's role in shaping Malawi's political landscape? Just how important a political figure was he?
Yeah, to start with, the age, which is the generational mark of the late vice president, is telling. This is an individual that was born, I think, around 1973. That's youthfulness, which is rare in Africa to find youthful leaders, youthful in the political sense of the word. And then also, this is a vice president that was coming from a scholarly background. This particular vice president was well-read in economics, in business, and environmental and nutritional affairs. And this was your technocrat who had local opposition politics in Malawi, local business development in Malawi, but also international exposure, working for such conglomerates and global entities like Unilever, Coca-Cola, and other entities, and leaving a record of success there, delivering, growing these conglomerates, and actually highlighting what Africans can also do in business and political leadership. And in brief, this was a popular politician in Malawi, a technocrat that was roughly trusted by the people.
Right. Are you able to give me a sense of his relationship with President Mutharika and how it evolved over time, and perhaps how important this was to the stability of politics in the country?
What you can summarize is a coalition relationship, in that there's a point where the vice president formed his own political party and became the vice president of Mutharika, and then was part of the present government as well. So he had oppositional profiles and also profiles of governing, that is working with the present regime as it is working and all that. And Malawians had it in mind that here is a possible successor, or here is a future president in the country. And he never delayed publicly expressing dissent, criticism, and condemnation of the established order, although he cooperated and all that. So here was what you can call a coalition relationship, in that people agreed to work and govern together, but their political oppositions, their political differences, and their political competencies and agendas are clear to all and sundry and all that. So he had an oppositional profile. And just to put it on record, there was a time where the vice president had allegations of some corruption against him, but these were cleared by the courts in Malawi, from what the records are saying.
What do you think the potential impact then of his death is going to be on the immediate future political landscape in the country, and particularly as the country heads to an election, if I'm not mistaken, next year?
There is really a political gap that has been created, in which, since the vice president died in an accident, Malawians did not plan for, the government of Malawi did not plan for. And as this is a political figure, having passed on in an accident, in a political and historical environment, every passing of a politician in an accident becomes a political question. As I speak, from a political analyst perspective, there are many questions around: is it an accident or an incident and all that? So there is going to be a gap. There's going to be controversy. There's going to be debate. We only hope this controversy, this debate, is not going to degenerate into feuds, into conflict, and into tensions, as it frequently happens in the African continent. Because the vice president had a national following, which national following is quite agitated and aggrieved.
And as you rightly point out, many questions around this aeroplane accident, accident or incident, as you put it. It's absolutely critical that authorities get to the bottom of that as quickly as possible to make sure that Malawians are reassured one way or another.
Exactly, because if you go to the circumstances of, we are told by some news report that the reports that he was reluctant to go on this trip and had to get to resort to the flight because he and his entourage could have driven there. There are sort of anecdotal, circumstantial issues around the trip itself that raise questions. And these questions arise more because we are dealing with a political figure, a historical figure, and someone that is closely positioned to power and future leadership in the Republic of Malawi. So it is important then that the powers that be, the authorities that be, quickly get into the meat of the matter as to what exactly happened, how it happened, so that the fears of the people of Malawi and the Africans and everybody could be allayed.
I am going to leave it there. Dr. William Mpofu, researcher at the Wits Center for Diversity Studies, thank you very much for that assessment. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there has been a general welcome to a government clampdown on de minimis rules that have allowed Chinese retailers like Shein and Temu to bring goods into the country at lower cost than their rivals. From the 1st of July, parcels that Chinese retailers bring in of below 500 rand in value are going to be taxed at exactly the same rate that local clothing retailers pay, namely 45% plus value added tax. All of this comes amid accusations that they've been using an extremely high number of small orders to pay lower duties. Let's explore this in a little more detail now. Gerard Janssen van Vuren is an equity analyst at Flagship Asset Management. And Gerard, firstly then, why do you think government has decided to clamp down?
The problems experienced is in terms of competition. I think the problems that we have seen is that retailers have felt that the minimus rules weren't correct in terms of safeguarding South Africa and the retail space in that sense.
So the real issue here is that these big companies have come in, they've taken a lot of market share. I'm wondering to myself, Gerard, if this move isn't too late, whether these big brands have not already entrenched themselves in the minds and I guess the wallets of the consumers.
The problem with the new competition in South Africa, I think the shift that you've already seen, it's quite difficult to shift customers' focus back onto yourself. So there might be a problem for retailers in South Africa to get their customers' eyes back on them.
So how difficult do you think it's going to be to enforce these new rules?
It might be relatively difficult. We've seen that there's normally quite a few loopholes with rules like these. And as we've seen in the past and everyone complaining about the entrance of the competitors, but I think we'll definitely have to need some cooperation between borders and SARS and different parties to make sure that this is effective.
So what are those potential loopholes then around the way in which the Chinese retailers have been using the system to bring clothing into the country? And how can you change or close those loopholes?
My understanding is that they've been shipping the products in smaller batches and therefore they've been sidestepping the minimus rules. The new focus would be to focus on these products themselves. So even a smaller shipment will not sidestep it anymore, which was a key concern for local retailers.
It's going to be very difficult, though, and you'll agree with me, to police all of this, given the high volume of goods that are coming in from these big retailers like Shein and Temu.
It will definitely be very difficult just looking at the market shares and how many people, just anecdotally speaking to different people. Everyone is ordering from Temu and Shein nowadays. So it will definitely be quite a problem to police and control this.
So we've got new rules that are being put in place. How quickly do you think it's going to benefit the local retail industry? Because they're going to have to step up their game, particularly in terms of price.
This might definitely be a wake-up call for local retailers in terms of prices and competition, and I definitely think that they will start focusing on this aspect in future just to prevent things like this happening.
So what do you think the big lesson learnt has been for the retail industry in this country?
There's always this key debate that people will have in economics, the debate being, well, should we protect our local industry, or should the saving that customers can get from this, should we allow customers to get that savings? Because our wallets are strained, and allowing customers to save that extra 10, 20, 50, 100 rand definitely allows them to spend on other necessities. So it's a very difficult debate because you also don't want to destroy jobs in South Africa, and you do want to protect your industry. It is quite a difficult stance to take either side of this, and therefore we need the regulators and people behind this to clearly evaluate what position they are taking and what the effects will be.
But it's a debate that we have the world over. On the one hand, it's job protection. On the other hand, it's letting the free market reign and letting the consumer make the choice. And there's no right or wrong answer to that, is there?
There's no right or wrong answer. I mean, in different countries, you'll see different responses. It depends a lot on the people in the country as well and their views on this, because they, in the end, sort of push the regulators to allow or disallow certain things. So yeah, there's definitely no right answer, but it is difficult. And just looking at our unemployment numbers, I don't think we can tolerate high unemployment at this stage, but we do need to focus on industries where we are competitive and where we can sort of outcompete the competition.
And that's exactly the issue. The retail industry in this country has got to become a whole lot more nimble, adept and competitive. And often they're not. They're very complacent and they allow big companies like Shein and Temu to come in.
Yes, perhaps a key question we need to ask is, do we need some form of government subsidies, or do we need the government in any way to support these industries better? Can government perhaps, in creating a friendlier business environment, lower the cost for these retailers and therefore making them more competitive? So it might not even be a regulator specific issue in itself. It might be the cost of doing business in South Africa. For example, insuring trucks that are traveling on the roads after diluting, that's increased. So it's quite a complex and interlinked debate, but I definitely think we need to evaluate all aspects of this chain and see if we can make our retail industry more competitive.
As you rightly say, very complicated, very complex and very multifaceted. But thank you very much indeed for the perspective. Gerard Janse van Vuren from Flagship Asset Management. Appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, the famous Timeout platform, which specializes in telling travelers what to do, what to see, what to eat and what to drink in the world's major cities, has chosen Johannesburg as one of the great centers for food on the planet. Well, what's behind that? I'm in conversation now with Barbara Gauganadiwe, who is Senior Manager, Destination and Communications at Gauteng Tourism. And first of all then, Barbara, what do you think has contributed to Johannesburg being given this accolade?
It's a great accolade indeed, and it's following on the backdrop of last accolade we received on us having some of the leading and globally acclaimed markets. As you know, markets, food, people, music forms part of competitive global city regions, mainly because of the cosmopolitan nature of the city. The city houses expatriates from all major parts of the world and the continent. And part of the expatriates' work is being able to integrate with the locals, feels at home, and this gives us an added advantage that we're able to accommodate all the other parts of the regions who are able to produce their dishes, but they have also been able to tap into the resounding Ubuntu and welcoming nature of the 15.5 million people, which we continuously insist they are our new gold, as we no longer have gold underneath.
In many ways, though, this accolade, you'll agree, is a bit of a hidden secret. And I wonder whether the city of Johannesburg, or Gauteng for that matter, capitalizes on the center being a food hub.
It's no longer a hidden secret. It's an open secret now. We have been knowing about it over some time. We have been packaging as the Gauteng Tourism Authority, working with South African Tourism, an elaborate plan that involved travel, trade, engagement, hosting foodies, influencers all over the world, also including our art and musical prowess. So all this are a culmination of the work we have put in many years. So the secret is out. You can imagine now enjoying some of the delicious cuisines in the sprawling sands of Johannesburg, supported by the conquering sounds of amapiano music that are also taking the world by storm. So these are part of the benefits of a growing creative city hub positioning, which we have been utilizing. We have been developing with our local trade partners, especially in areas like Melville, in areas like Soweto, Maboneng, in areas like Sandton, in areas like Alex, a food route where you are able to go to Foxberg and get some of the delicious spices that you can't get anywhere else. You are able to get our quotas in our townships. You are able to pay mohodu and our expensive champagnes in joints in like Konka. So these are some of the work that has been done and put in many years. What needs to happen for us is to capitalize on it, solidify it, bring in new players, tour operators, upsellers that are able to then use this as part of the new offerings that we punt and sell to the world.
So what are you doing in that respect? How can the city further leverage this recognition and boost tourism and obviously local businesses? Do that and you're creating jobs, aren't you?
Absolutely. Hence, we are working with the Restaurant Association of South Africa, RASA Ward, in introducing what we call our Golden Star gratification, which is a first of its kind in the country, where we will be accrediting firstly township-based restaurants and food and eateries that are distinguishing and showing themselves above others. This golden plaque that we will be pioneering with the Restaurant Association will look at restaurants in the townships and not restaurants in Sandton, in mainland and other affluent areas. So this is part of the initiative that we are doing to formalize it, to put norms and standards into it. We are contributing to the development of the food and gastronomy tourism framework led by the National Department of Tourism. We have volunteered ourselves. We are also working with the Grading Council and some of the Cat Sitters initiative to actually train these foodies. We have opened up intake of more than 50 traders for the Delicious Festival Traders Academy, working together with our Harangua Hotel School, the Johannesburg Culinary and Pastry School. So these are some of the behind-the-scenes efforts to formalize this, make this a growing phenomenon, and in the process, accommodate thousands of young people who are looking for opportunities, who are looking for jobs, and this bodes well for the growing Vista economy.
And all of that sounds like very good news, but you'll also agree with me that it is a high-risk industry. One, it's difficult for people to break into it and be successful, in other words, to sustain it. And second of all, crime is always a problem at destination precincts.
And that is why we continuously punt. And you will have seen our showcase at this year's Africa's Travel in Durban. We were the only one who have pulled in the Johannesburg Traffic Police Department and all our Metro Police and our crime prevention wardens to be part of our showcase at Africa's Travel in Durban to demonstrate our commitment to fighting crime head on. It continues to be an inhibitor. But also we have started to see communities, we have started to see joints. A place like Wamaimai, which traditionally is seen as a place where taxi drivers converge and get their food, it's now a melting pot of different cultures enjoying the food and the like. And the security have been upped, but it's the patrol themselves that have started to see the benefit of that being a safe and livable space, but also an inclusive space that accommodates the cosmopolitan and diverse nature of Johannesburg. So not only are efforts from government and us as tourism bodies, but products themselves have also seen the need to intensify law enforcement. We have seen in the Maboneng precincts, the likes of APSA and other businesses also contributing to the neighborhood watch. We think this is a positive sign. And with these accolades continues to create jobs and building the brand for the destination, we think all partners will start seeing the fruits of this and we will be able to deal with these brand killers.
Thank you very much for joining me. And that's where we are going to leave things for today. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.